I watch a lot of television, and if there's one character who's dominating prestige TV more than any other, it's the anti-hero.
I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. I am the one who knocks.
Is he a bad guy? Is he a good guy? We're not supposed to be sure.
How do we know if we're in control? No, we're not just making the best of what comes at us, and that's it.
American history is full of real-life anti-heroes. Guys who did the wrong thing, but maybe there was an even greater wrong done to them. Maybe they never had a fair shot in the first place. I'm going to tell you a story about two guys who you've probably heard of, Nicolas Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. And I'll tell you the truth, I don't know if these guys are worth rooting for. I do know that they have gone down in history as symbols of a failed system, a system that promised fairness and didn't deliver. So we're going to leave it up to you. Here's the story of Sacco and Vanzetti and the trial that shocked the world.
My name is Peter Agnes, A-G-N-E-S.
If we're going to talk justice, who better to talk to than an actual justice?
For approximately 21 years, I was a trial judge, first in the district court and then in the superior court for 11 years.
Judge Agnes is going to help me tell this story. He's an associate justice on the appeals court in Massachusetts. He knows his stuff, and he's an amateur historian of the Sacco and Vanzetti case. We'll talk about why he knows so much about the case in a second, but in the meantime, let's go back to the start of the 20th century. Between 1900 and 1915, 3 million Italians immigrated to America. Among them were Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. These were two working-class men who eventually made their way to Massachusetts. Sacco was a skilled shoe cutter. Vanzetti did several different kinds of work to make ends meet, eventually working as a fish peddler in Plymouth. This is pretty much every immigrant story from the 1900s, except
they became associated with an anarchist circle in East Boston that followed and supported the views of a radical anarchist named Luigi Galliani. But he was regarded as one of the most dangerous anarchist leaders in the United States because he espoused not only the replacement of government and the overthrow of government, but he espoused the use of force to do that.
Galliani's followers were responsible for planting a suitcase full of dynamite at the Massachusetts State House on New Year's Day 1916. Later that year, they successfully set off a bomb at a North End police station. 3 years later, anarchists with ties to Galliani bombed the homes of a judge and a state representative. Needless to say, Sacco and Vanzetti had made some pretty dangerous friends. Is it fair to compare that to being a part of a terrorism cell?
Yes. The anarchists of that era, certainly the followers of Luigi Galliani, were not what might be described as, you know, philosophical anarchists, but there were people in the circle that Sacco and Vanzetti were associated with who believed in direct action and violent action.
In 1917, Sacco and Vanzetti left the U.S. for Mexico. They wanted to avoid being drafted into the U.S. Army during World War I. Upon their return, they continued to associate with radical anarchists. Around this time, the communist revolution in Russia inspired radicals from many different political movements to take action against their governments. In the U.S., this stirred up a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment. Some concluded that these radical political activities were problems that immigrants were bringing into the U.S. from Europe. Even if only a tiny minority of immigrants were involved, immigrants as a whole faced increased scrutiny from law enforcement and the government. On April 15, 1920, five men staged a brutal robbery in Braintree. A paymaster named Parmenter and a guard named Bertadelli were shot and killed while transporting the payroll of the Slater and Morrill shoe factory. Most investigators suspected professional criminals. When the getaway car was found in the West Bridgewater woods, a local police chief had a different theory, that an Italian anarchist living in town was involved. The man's car was under repair at Johnson's garage, and the chief set a trap. When five Italian men arrived to pick it up, they were told that it could not be released without current license plates. Police were notified. One by one, the men were rounded up. In Brockton, a policeman boarded a streetcar and arrested Sacco and Vanzetti. Both were caught armed with spent bullet shells. When questioned about their anarchist politics, they lied to the police. The three other men were quickly released without charges. One had a time card showing that he had been at work the day of the robbery. What were those men doing that night? We may never know. Possibly they were disposing of anarchist literature or bomb-making materials that were unrelated to the robbery.
Of course, when they were arrested and they were questioned for several days, they were never told what they were arrested for.
Sacco and Vanzetti were not arrested for bomb plots. They were arrested for murder. And from the beginning, things weren't looking good for Sacco and Vanzetti. Let's start with how the police got eyewitnesses to identify Sacco and Vanzetti as the shooters.
So Sacco and Vanzetti were in a jail cell. They were asked to assume the pose that witnesses had described the shooters had used at the time of the crime, and then the witnesses were paraded in front of them and asked to make an identification. They were extraordinarily suggestive identifications.
Today, our laws try to reduce that kind of suggestiveness. Witnesses look at a set of pictures, and they tell the police if they recognize the people involved in the crime. But that wasn't the only evidence against Sacco and Vanzetti. There were also the guns they were carrying on that streetcar.
The gun that Vanzetti had on his person, according to the Commonwealth at the trial, was the gun that Berardelli, one of the victims, had on his person. So the government's theory was Vanzetti is guilty of this crime because when we arrested him, he had the victim's gun on his person. Now that's powerful evidence.
The only problem? That evidence wasn't true. A document released in 1977 showed that the serial number on Vanzetti's gun didn't match the serial number on Berardelli's gun.
Moreover, it's been established that the government knew this at the time of the trial in 1921 and never disclosed this to the defense.
If you're keeping count, thus far, witnesses identified Sacco and Vanzetti under dubious circumstances, and the government knowingly presented false evidence that Vanzetti was holding the victim's gun. But it gets worse. The government presented evidence at trial that at least one of the bullets pulled from the bodies was fired from Sacco's gun.
After the trial, one of the witnesses who testified for the government about the firearms and the bullets was a man named Proctor. He signed an affidavit that the defense used in an effort to obtain a new trial that said, "I was pressured before the trial by the prosecution to say that the bullet in question had been fired from Sacco's gun. I could not say that. There was no evidence of that. So I said at their request that that bullet was consistent with a bullet fired from Sacco's gun."
This was in the days before CSI. Ballistics was in its infancy, and Proctor's testimony was deliberately misleading. But that's not what the prosecutor said to the jury. He said the bullet was fired from Sacco's gun. In fact, five of the six bullets didn't match either gun. But the prosecution wasn't relying on physical evidence alone.
The most significant evidence that really persuaded the jury, who might have had some doubts, was what we call consciousness of guilt.
Consciousness of guilt means that you're acting like a guilty person. You know, mom asks if you've been in the cookie jar. You say no, but you immediately go to wipe something sticky off your face and ask for a tall glass of milk. That's consciousness of guilt. No matter what you say, you're acting like a person who's been in the cookie jar.
Consciousness of guilt can be very powerful and useful evidence by a jury if it's, number one, truthful, and number two, if the conduct that is said to be consciousness of guilt is conduct connected with the crime that the person's accused of.
So Sacco and Vanzetti were carrying guns. They'd lied about why they'd been in Bridgewater, and the police testified that when they approached Sacco and Vanzetti, they reached for their guns. they acted pretty suspiciously in general. But remember, they weren't told that they were being arrested for murder.
If the behavior of two people who were arrested for a crime that they weren't informed of is then said at their trial to be evidence that they're conscious of the guilt of that crime, it's very misleading.
In other words, if you're acting guilty about those cookies, and mom uses it as evidence that you've been stealing money from her purse, that's improper use of consciousness of guilt. When it came down to it, none of the holes in the prosecution's case ended up making a difference. Sacco and Vanzetti's case came to trial at a critical moment for the Massachusetts judicial system.
What was peculiar about the Sacco Vanzetti case is it was one of the first cases in Massachusetts that was tried by one judge.
Prior to the 1920s, Massachusetts criminal trials were heard by a panel of judges. For example, the Lizzie Borden trial in 1893 was heard by three judges. But the backlog of criminal cases had grown in the early 20th century, and the judicial system changed.
And people thought, you know, one Superior Court judge, one learned, experienced Superior Court judge with a jury can provide people with a fair trial, and it will allow the other judges to be doing other things. So let's try that system.
From the moment the trial began, it was clear that the judge chosen to preside over this case, this one learned judge, had a unique take on the proceedings.
Webster Thayer is reported to have said to many different people, before, during, and after the Sacco Vanzetti case, things that reflect a bias, things that indicate that he saw his mission as one in which the conviction and imprisonment or execution of these dangerous radicals was an important step in preserving the liberty and safety of his community.
Webster Thayer used coded language in court that gave away his bias against Sacco and Vanzetti.
Mr. Foreman and gentlemen of the jury, you may remain seated. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts called upon you to render a most important service. Although you knew that such service would be arduous, yet you, like the true soldier, responded to that call in the spirit of supreme American loyalty. There is no better word in the English language than loyalty. For he who is loyal to God, to country, to his state, and to his fellow man represents the highest and noblest type of true American citizenship.
In his instructions to the jury, he spoke about the importance of loyalty to God, to country, and to state as the highest and noblest type of citizenship. Well, Sacco and Vanzetti were atheists. They had left the United States in 1917 to avoid the draft. And contrary to, I think, sound strategy, their trial lawyer brought out evidence about their anarchist views and their political views that allowed the prosecutor in turn to bring out a large amount of evidence about their views that were contrary to what might be described as the views of a good, patriotic, loyal American citizen.
Judge Thayer had recently presided over another case against Vanzetti, one in which he was tried and convicted of armed robbery. In that case, Thayer had doled out the harshest sentence possible. The case had been unsolved, and many suspect that the Commonwealth tried to push that case through on weak evidence in order to impeach Vanzetti in the eyes of the jury.
Gentlemen of the jury, have you agreed upon a verdict?
We have.
Hold up your right hand, Mr. Foreman. Look upon the prisoner. Prisoner, look upon the foreman. What say you, Mr. Foreman? Is the prisoner at the bar guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
Guilty of murder?
Murder.
In the first degree?
In the first degree.
Upon each indictment?
Yes, sir.
The jury delivered a guilty verdict on July 14, 1921.
Now, if there's one thing that we say in our country when you go on trial and are charged with a crime, is that we're going to present this case to a group of impartial people and we're going to have an impartial judge try the case.
But Webster Thayer wasn't impartial. He'd been outspoken against Sacco and Vanzetti, especially in comments overheard outside the courtroom.
Did you see what I did with those anarchist bastards the other day? I guess that'll hold them for a while. Now, a bunch of parlor radicals are trying to get those Italian bastards off. Well, I'll see them hanged. And I'd like to hang a few dozen of the radicals.
He denied the defense's request for a new trial, even when he was presented with new evidence.
Many issues that were alleged to have been errors at the trial were brought to the attention of the Supreme Judicial Court. The Supreme Judicial Court was unable to effectively review them because the law at the time said the Supreme Court could not look at the facts, they could only look at the law.
This system worked fine when three judges were presiding over murder cases, but when you were down to one judge, no matter how unbiased he might want to be, there needed to be a better check on that one judge's judicial power.
If a mistake was made, it's important that there also be in place an effective way to correct the mistake.
And that's possibly the most lasting legacy of the Sacco and Vanzetti case. The Massachusetts Bar Association advocated for change in the years after the trial. They wanted to make it harder for one biased judge to put someone away for life or send them to death row. Today, the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts reviews all first-degree murder cases, both the facts of the case and the law. But it was too late for Sacco and Vanzetti. Webster Thayer's ruling stood. And on August 23, 1927, Sacco and Vanzetti were executed. These were Vanzetti's last words.
Maybe the most fundamental, the most important principle in our justice system is that when people stand before the law, everyone is equal. You know, we say that in a Declaration of Independence. We know these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal. And the Massachusetts Constitution, the very first line of the very first article of the Declaration of Rights, speaks about people's equality. And that is the principle from which everything else is derived. You know, equality before the law and the right to hold dangerous, radical, extremist views are two of the ingredients that make the Sacco and Vanzetti case worth studying, because those are things we struggle with every day today.
In our country, even people who hate our laws, our government, or our culture are supposed to get a fair trial.
And that's the challenge that, you know, the United States justice system has faced from the very beginning. It's the challenge that we faced in the wake of 9/11. And it's the challenge that we face today when, you know, we're concerned about terrorist incidents occurring in the United States. If someone is arrested and prosecuted and there's a link between that person and terrorism, can we provide them with a fair trial?
After Sacco and Vanzetti's execution, there was outrage across the country and across the world, from anarchists, from lawyers, and from people who felt a great injustice had been done. 50 years later, Governor Michael Dukakis issued a proclamation naming August 23, 1977, Sacco and Vanzetti Memorial Day, and declaring that any disgrace should be forever removed from their names. This wasn't a pardon, but an acknowledgement that our justice system had failed these two people. Peter Agnes worked for Governor Dukakis back then, and the proclamation is what sparked his interest in the case. As a judge, he comes back to this case again and again when he's on the bench.
I think first and foremost, a judge has to see the individual as a human being and not simply see the conduct that they're accused of committing. And if you can't look out at someone as a judge and think that despite the horrible thing that they're charged with, and despite the horrible act that they might have actually committed, that that person is actually more like me than they are different from me, then I think you can't judge them in the way that our system of justice intends that they be judged.
Voices from the Vault is produced and hosted by me, Anna Fisher Pinkert. Our executive producer is Steve Kenny. Special thanks to our voice actors, Michael McAfee, Stephanie Fisher, Dan Hoare, Zach Herman, and Andrew S. Weiss. To learn more about Sacco and Vanzetti, or to listen to our past episodes, visit www.commonwealthmuseum.org.